That's your question?
What's a schnerzen?
Okay, I wrote it wrong. Yes, yeah, a schnerzen. Okay. This is a tough one, obviously, because... Right. Well, for all the obvious reasons. Let's start like this. Rav Lichtenstein was maspid, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, in this base medrash upstairs. And he started as follows. You need to know something about Wordsworth, which I didn't, so I looked it up. But apparently Wordsworth did some, like, questionable things in the last few years of his life. So when the person was maspid Wordsworth, he said, you know, this eulogy would be much easier to deliver had he died 5 years earlier. So Rav Lichtenstein said the same thing about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It would be much easier to talk about the Lubavitcher Rebbe had the last 5 years of his life not existed. Now, what happened in the last 5 years of his life? He was completely incapacitated, but that's when the whole Mashiach movement started. Okay, there's also, like, when Moshe has some joke. What does Lubavitcher Rebbe, what do the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Moshe Rabbeinu have in common? Right? Moshe Rabbeinu, everybody knows that he's dead, but nobody knows where he's buried. Lubavitcher Rebbe, the opposite. Okay, like, everybody knows where his kever is, but I could say this for myself. I'm old enough to remember when the Rebbe passed away. I'm old enough to have lived through a lot of these things. I remember thinking to myself, okay, this is interesting, but at the end of the day, you're not going to be able to follow. Sorry. But at the end of the day, once he dies, it'll be over. And then it wasn't. Okay? So let's start at the beginning. Chabad is not a regular Hasidus. Okay, it's and this isn't an insult at all. It's not a regular Hasidus. You know, the number of Chabad Hasidim in the world is very limited. But the number of people who associate themselves with Chabad is much, much larger, right? They're not looking to make Chabad Hasidim. They're looking to make people who are associated with it. You know, I would think in the world right now, I can't say this for sure, but I would think most people who are associated with Chabad are not Shomer Shabbos. You know, they go to Chabad shuls. Maybe they drive there, right? I'm not saying this is a criticism. It's just a fact. It's not fair to compare Chabad to other Hasiduses because there's no, you know, Vishnitz Chassid in the world who's not Shomer Shabbos, right? But there are people who associate and would tell you, yes, I'm Chabad, but they're not Shomer Shabbos. And that's not to say it's good or bad. Okay? Next thing. The Rebbe was apparently, and by all people who know, an enormous Talmud Chacham. And he apparently wrote 300, there are 300 Sfarim of his Torah in the world, and that's all great. But that's not who he really was. Meaning in a discussion about the Lubavitcher Rebbe and his impact on the world, right, a vart he had on Erech and Samach Zayin doesn't really matter. Right? That's not who he was about. And that's not what we're going to discuss today. Okay, let's talk about him. Let's first do some biographical information. The Rebbe was born in the Black Sea port of Nikolaev, some little Russian town. It's actually interesting because now it's in the Ukraine. Like, it's that part that people fight about all the time. Okay, he's born into a Chabad family, but how Chabad is not 100% clear. You could say, well, it must be pretty Chabad. His name is Menachem Mendel. You know, which is the Mittler Rebbe's name, you know, the third of the Lubavitcher Rebbe's. They're somehow Chabad, but not completely so. In 1907, when he's 6 years old, his family moves to some larger city where his father, conveniently named Levi Yitzchak, another sign that they must be slightly more Chabad than people say, was appointed the chief rabbi. Okay? And they lived there till 1939. When he was basically exiled by the Soviets to Kazakhstan. Okay? Just interesting to note, the Rebbe had two younger brothers. One named Dov Ber, who was murdered by allies of the Nazis in 1944, and Yisrael Aryeh Leib, who died in 1952 while he was completing his doctoral studies in Liverpool University. Okay, make of that what you want. Those are the two Rebbe's brothers. They didn't survive. Because he was an Ilui from his birth, he basically never went to yeshiva. So then who taught him? He had Malamdim. He certainly didn't go to any Chabad yeshiva. If you research his past, and you know, since his death, many people have researched his path to figure out the answer to this question. You know, was he groomed? Was he always going to be the Rebbe? We'll talk about that a little bit. But he has an interesting background. He didn't go to any Chabad yeshivas. He learned with tutors. He did pass, you know, like Bagriot, like secular studies, like regents from Russia. He was clearly very well educated as a child. His father believed broadly in secular education. Now, this is the thing that official Chabad history, you know, kind of denies, right? Chabad history says he was a Talmud Chacham. He got smicha from the Rugged Shover. He got smicha from the Sri De'esh. I don't know if he actually got pieces of paper from them, but he didn't learn in any yeshivas. He wasn't, you know, it wasn't the way they presented. Now, why would they present it this way? And here I feel comfortable in saying it. Like, Chabad is into the history that the Rebbe was always going to be the Rebbe, right? I don't know why they need that history. I'll be frank with you. Like, I think it's more impressive if the Rebbe wasn't going to be the Rebbe. He was going to be an engineer somewhere, and he decided to become the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he became the most successful Rebbe ever. That was, if it was me and I was in charge of Chabad, that's the story I'd be pushing. I also suspect that it's true. But they're not into that story. They're into the story that, of course, he was going to be the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I'll mention in a few minutes why I think they're into that story. But let's leave that for a second. In 1923, for reasons that are not at all clear, the Rebbe's 21 years old. He visits, for the first time, the then Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Yosef Yitzchok Schneerson, okay, in Europe. This is unbelievable. In his house, he's visiting. I don't know what he's doing. They introduce himself. They're learning. They're talking. He meets one of the Rebbe's. He meets the Rebbe's middle daughter, whose name is Chaya Mushka, who he eventually marries. Like, they weren't set up. Like, he went there and he met her. Like, I don't know. She's doing the laundry. She was cooking lunch. I don't know if they spoke. Apparently, they met each other and they liked each other. And, you know, it took a while because life was busy and life was complicated. But in 1928, they got married. He was 27. She was 28. Okay? They stayed married for 60 years. Like, it was a good marriage, except for the thing that you most want from a marriage, which never happened, which is children. Okay? It's an open question of why, you know, they never adopted. I really like... I can speculate. Anybody can speculate. Chabad people would say, the Rebbe had millions of children. What are you talking about? And they say it seriously. But the Rebbe didn't have any children. You know, basically, his whole life, he lived with his wife. She was almost his only friend. Like, you know, there was no one else on his level. He didn't know. In Chabad, like, there's no one who could talk to the Rebbe like an equal. And so he was pretty marginalized in terms of his interaction with the world. Again, in terms of kids, in terms of adoption, like anything I could say, you could say, I don't know. I find it to be like a fascinating biographical question, which is why, you know, somebody who's so important to the world and to Jews, you know, didn't adopt. I don't know. Okay, but meanwhile, they're still in Europe. It's still before the war, okay? It's 1928. They're married. They move to Berlin, where the Rebbe studies math, physics and philosophy at the University of Berlin. We're good? Okay, otherwise I'll... Okay. His classmates, a bunch of Germans, I suppose, and two famous people, Nechama Leibowitz and the Rav. Okay? You know, how close they were to each other. There's one story, this is unbelievable, there's one story, Chabad pushes the story, you could find it online, that on Purim one year, the Rebbe drank too much, and he landed up in jail for disorderly conduct. It is unbelievable. And the Rav bailed him out, okay? And on the way out, the Rav said to him, hey, now that you've been in jail, you could be the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Because all the previous rabbis were in jail also, you know, for other purposes. Okay, but that's a story, like, in the world that they want, which is that the Rebbe was always going to be the Rebbe. Okay, so the Rav made that joke, and it turned out to be true. Okay, in 1933, after the rise of the Nazi Party, they moved to Paris, which was slightly safer at the time, where he studied engineering in the Sorbonne. Again, like, this is not to say that he didn't actually learn Daf Yomi or other things at the time, but this is his life, right? He's pursuing advanced, you know, knowledge and advanced degrees in things other than Torah. In 1940, when the Nazis took Paris, they ran away to Vichy, and then to Nice, and then eventually they made it to America. Okay? Now, let's ask ourselves, who was the Rebbe at this point? Again, he is the son-in-law of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, but otherwise, at least from my perspective, he shows no signs of being attached to Chabad at all. He has no connection. He just happens to be married to the previous Rebbe's daughter, but his life, the arc of his life, seems to be to become an engineer, to get a degree. You know, that's what it is. That's the person who arrives in New York at the time, you know, to escape the Nazis. Again, the official Lubavitch version is he came to New York to be Lubavitcher Rebbe. The facts seem certainly not to support this completely, if at all. Okay, when he gets to New York, he's like any other survivor, right? He lost his family in the war. He lost most of his family. He has no real career plan. He starts out being an engineer in New York. And then he starts attaching himself a little bit to his father-in-law's ideas, certainly about bringing the Mashiach, right? The previous Rebbe, who's known as the Friedicher Rebbe, also was obsessed, seems like a judgmental word, but certainly very invested in the idea of Mashiach. And that attack, the Rebbe liked that. Okay, he wrote one letter at the time about how we could bring Mashiach, but again, he's not the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he's just an engineer. Although that may be where things start. I assume he was aware, as was his wife, that, you know, his father-in-law had one son. His name, it depends how you say it. If you say Barry Gurari, so it sounds like Barry Gurari can't be Lubavitcher Rebbe, right, you know. He had a real name. Well, let's do it this way. Okay. In 1950, Rav Yitzchak Yosef Schneerson, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, passes away. Okay. His oldest son-in-law, that would be the son of his... Why is it his son-in-law? I'm not sure. I wrote that. His own son-in-law is Rav Shmariyahu Gurari, who in English is Barry. Okay? He actually lived with Rav Yitzchak Yosef. You know, he and his wife took care of the Rebbe. They lived with him. That was their life. Presumably, he was in line to be the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's not clear whether he actually wanted to be the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Right? That, like, they can't make you be the Rebbe. They had this other Hasidus the Boyana Rebbe, for example, right? So the Boyana Rebbe's, the person who was in line didn't want to be the Rebbe. So they took somebody else who actually went to MTA at the time. It's like a bizarre story. He comes from America. He's wildly successful. Okay, it's pretty similar to what happened with Chabad, except it wasn't that simple. At the Shiva, there started to be tension. There basically were two separate shivas. There was Rav Shmariyahu Gurari, who sat in one room, and there was Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who sat in another room, who cried for a week. It could be, you know, why exactly the person who wasn't that close to his father-in-law cried the whole time, I don't know. But he cried the whole week, and he showed an incredible closeness to the previous Rebbe, even though the facts are otherwise. Yes? I guess somebody had to be the Rebbe. So the issue was out there. There was a rumor. I'm sorry. Rav Shmariyahu Gurari was his son-in-law. He didn't want to be the Rebbe. But his son was the Rebbe's grandson. Barry Gurari, Shalom Dov Bear, his from name, was the Rebbe's grandson. And there was a rumor that, Rav Yitzchak Yosef wanted his grandson to be the Rebbe. But they never found any documentation to it. Again, the grandson went to Brooklyn College, and it's very, very possible that he didn't want to be the Rebbe either. Okay, but there's huge competition. They have separate minyanim at Shiva, which makes it think that there's a fight going on. But the Lubavitcher Rebbe is the Lubavitcher Rebbe, meaning it's not like he just got the job. He got the job and he was great at it, right? He started giving sichos immediately after the shiva, basically campaigning for the job. But when he started speaking, people said, this guy's brilliant and he's fantastic. And so he started taking over the movement. He officially becomes the Lubavitcher Rebbe on the yard site of his father-in-law. So that's a full year later. But, you know, and in his initial Maimar, it's hard to explain what a Maimar is, but for Hasidus, it's like an important thing. It is in his initial Maimar, he starts speaking about Mashiach immediately. And he talks about how he's the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, and Moshe Rabbeinu was the seventh generation of Avraham Avinu, and the seven and the sevens and the sevens are really important. We're in Sfira, seven really matters. He's the seventh Rebbe. Okay, that's how it starts. Again, to be clear, whether he was supposed to be the Rebbe or not, I think it's more impressive if he wasn't, especially when you look back on history. He was the right person, right? He made Chabad into an international movement. He was incredible. You know, there's no question that he did the right thing. You know, whether Chabad is right for trying to pretend that that was the history that had to be, I'm not so sure. Yes?
Were this whole idea of sending Shlichim, was that his idea?
Yeah, it's all him. We'll come to that. What's the major shift that the Lubavitcher Rebbe introduces, not just to Orthodox Judaism, but to Judaism as a whole? The answer is, till then, we'd basically been playing defense. You know, we're Jews, we're under attack, we want to strengthen ourselves inwardly, we want to survive. Okay? Lubavitcher Rebbe has no interest in surviving. He wants to thrive. He wants to make God public, he wants to do things publicly, he wants people to be aware of these issues. It's a sea change in the way we look at, you know, we look at Judaism. He had no interest in church-state separation. We've talked about this before, in Rav Aaron Kotler, whatever. You know, church-state separation is useful for us if we're terrified that if we find out about Christmas, we'll start celebrating Christmas. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe wasn't interested. He wasn't afraid of Christmas. He was in favor of Hanukkah. He thought if you put it out on the table, no one would celebrate Christmas. You get one present. I think he was aware of the fact that Hanukkah, you get eight presents. Okay. This is a huge shift. Okay. He has a vision for the future of Judaism, and it involves Jewish outreach, which had not been done before. You know, and not only does he have a vision, he sees it through. There's a lot of visionaries in the world. Lubavitcher Rebbe, for all that he was incredibly powerful, and he was also the first CEO we ever had of a Hasidus, right? He built a structure that, you know, allowed for more work to be done than one person could do. Here's a good example. In 1951, he establishes the Chabad Women's Organization. No one had a women's organization in 1951. Who are the women? Who are no women? He started an organization. It was hugely successful. When the New York Times did, you know, every day on the every Friday on the cover of the New York Times, it told you when candle lighting was. Chabad sponsored, you know, the candle lighting. I remember when they made like a spoof New York Times from 2100, they had on the cover, you know, candle lighting of that day as part of the joke. But he did that, okay? In 1951, he sends his first shaliach ever to, doesn't matter, Morocco, where he met Rav Gigi. The Gigis were there in 1951, that's for sure. Okay, in 1960, he starts the first mitzvah campaign. You know, tefillin, Shabbos candles, v'ahavta l'recha, kamocha, things that people in the world never heard of. Here's an important point. You know, you ask yourself, and I remember thinking this when I was a kid also, like, what's the difference? You grab some guy in a train station, you put tefillin on him for 45 seconds. Did you change his life? So Rav Lichtenstein, in his hesped for the Rebbe, said one of the big things that the Rebbe introduced to Judaism was partial success. The guy wore tefillin. Is it going to make him frum? Is it going to put him in Gan Eden? You know, I think things have moved since then to, you know, but he thought, Lubavitcher Rebbe believed in incremental successes. He believed that you got a guy to come to shul. Okay, he drove to shul. And maybe he'll drive to shul next week. But maybe at some point, who knows? The idea of partial success was a big deal in Lubavitch philosophy. Again, it reminds us of Rav Kook, who also believed in partial success. You know, you could see both sides. But it's true that Chabad doesn't really make people frum. They connect people to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is not a small thing. They connect people to Mashiach. They connect people to, you know, to big ideas, but they don't really make people be Shomer Shah. There are very few people who like became genuinely frum through Chabad. I shouldn't say very few, because I'm sure everybody knows a handful. But you know, it's not really the point. Yes. I don't know. Okay. He starts a Hanukkah campaign. Everybody has to light Hanukkah menorah. Right? This was a big thing. More than that, he maybe even against halacha, he starts lighting Hanukkah candles like in public squares. Right? There's nothing about Times Square that requires a menorah in Times Square. Right? That's a Chabad thing. But the whole idea, which was a big First Amendment thing, you know, Chabad was in the Supreme Court all the time. Because Chabad believed that we should have a right to light menorahs. And now, the question is, well, if you have a right to light menorahs, so my baby Jesus also needs a place to be there. Now, the Rebbe, I think, would say, great. You put your Jesus there. I'll light menorah here. I'll win. You know, is it true? I don't know. But Chabad was in favor of that, and they did it. Again, it's ironic. Liberals hated should hate Chabad because they were against church-state issues. But liberals love Chabad. You know, the people who are in favor of church-state separation, they don't like so much. It's strange. Okay, that's local politics. What about Israel? So here's really the bizarre thing. The Rebbe was a huge Zionist, except the Rebbe didn't believe that you should live in Israel or that you had to live in Israel, right? The Rebbe said, "Bechol hamakom asher azkir eshemi." You could worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu anywhere, right? Now, there is a Kfar Chabad, and it's not like the Rebbe was against it, but he wasn't in favor of it either. I think Kfar Chabad has like a copy of 770, right? That whole thing is bizarre, you know. But these... What? Yeah, no, I passed that. That's pretty cool looking.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, you know... Okay. The cooler thing is when they get some guy fights for years to get the address to actually be 770. Right? Like there's some kind of kium in that. Okay. I don't understand it. Now, he never ever visited Israel. Not once. And he never sent shlichim to Israel. On the other hand, he was an incredible Zionist. And he was hugely influential. Not just that Netanyahu and Sharon and all the prime ministers went to visit him in 770 when they went in. I saw, this is unbelievable, online there's a picture of his funeral, and Netanyahu's right next to the kever. I remember when he died, like I don't remember that being played up at all, but it's interesting. You know, he was a player in the Gulf War. Like I remember, he made statements, and not just they reported in the press here, but it mattered that the Rebbe wasn't, you know, he was against any kind of peace deal. He wasn't against peace deals, he was against giving back any land. How could he give back any land? It's not yours to give back. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know, this is all part of it. Okay. 1988, Chaya Mushka, his wife of 60 years, passes away. Now he is literally alone. Literally alone. Okay. He had a Seder by himself. Now, there are a million Chabad guys who would make a Seder with the Rebbe. Like, I can't understand how it would be, right? On a night where you're supposed to ask questions and give... You know, I read someplace where this guy said he met the Rebbe like at 1 in the morning, Pesach night, he went for a walk after a Seder, completely by himself. But more than that, you have to ask yourself, you know, what happens to a person who's as successful as he is, who now has nobody to bounce any ideas off, right? There's nobody in Chabad who would disagree with the Rebbe, right? I heard from the, you know, there's a famous story, the Rav went to, they made the 70th birthday party for the Rebbe. So the Rav, who had a relationship with him, whatever, whether the story's true or not, they had a relationship from Berlin. You know, he went, and I happened to know the guy who took him, who said afterwards in the car, he said, you know, to the Rav, is the Rebbe a genius? And the Rav said, you know, to be a genius, you have to be challenged. I mean, no one ever challenged the Rebbe, because, you know, he's the Rebbe. So that's a problem. So now he has nobody. When he turns 90, He announces that he's done all he can to bring Mashiach. Now it's up to us. Then he has a second stroke and he loses the ability to talk. And the idea that he's the Mashiach really catches on. Now, anything that happens past this date, no one has any ideas what he thought. He couldn't talk. He was incapacitated. Yes, some guy says they took him out of the balcony on 770 and he was singing, you know, the Mashiach song, and he waved his hand. Okay, maybe he waved his hand because he had an itch. Like, really, no one has any idea. But that, you know, that's when the idea really took off. And it's really dangerous. There is no source. There is no real source in Judaism for the idea of a person dying and coming back to life. In fact, I remember, because I lived through this whole thing, you know, the Jews for Jesus put up this huge billboard after the Rebbe died. It was genius. It was a big picture of the Rebbe, who everybody recognized, and it said, right idea, wrong man. Okay? That's fantastic. You know, if you're going to have a guy who came back to life, let it be Jesus. Why would it be, the idea that, you know, it's always been the case that in Judaism we can have somebody who dies and comes back to life. It's never been the case. You know, yeah, there's some Medrash and Shir Hashirim and some other bizarre sources if you put them all together, but it's never been the case. And it's a dangerous thing to suggest that. It's dangerous because it's wrong. It's also dangerous because, okay, then I'll run my own candidate. Let Rav Lichtenstein be, you know, why him? Why not the Rav? Why not Rabbi Akiva? Why not Tanan? Why, like, what is it about the Rebbe that, you know, what are the, I have nothing bad to say about the Rebbe, God forbid, he's a gadol. But the question of why he would be the Mashiach, if it was really the case that anybody could do it, nobody should believe for a second that it's supported by any normative sources in Judaism. Yes?
Can it be connected with the idea of Tchiyat HaMetim?
No, if everybody's going to come back, so, okay, so there'll be an election, Rabbi Ryan. Yes, could it be connected to Tchiyas HaMeisim? The answer is, their idea is it's not connected to Tchiyas HaMeisim. You know, what percentage of, so, you know, depending on who you meet, there'll be those people in Chabad who say, the only crazy people really believe that. You know, okay. What's interesting is, we have a Chabad guy in our yeshiva. He's fantastic. He told me that in 770, the people who believe that the Rebbe is the Mashiach don't go into his office, because it's like the Kodesh HaKadosh. You can't just walk in. So, like, you know, if you go to 770, you could walk into his office, because the guys who really think this stuff, you know, they're afraid of going into the office. Okay, something we could do now, just for a second, which is, I see no connection between, you know, the Baal HaTanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, between Chassidus and Chabad. Not just that, you know, the Baal HaTanya thought you should daven Vatikin, you know, and Chabad now thinks it's also to daven before 10. Which is like, again, I just think it's insane. You know, the Tufel becomes the Iker, the Iker becomes the Tufel. Like, okay, the Rebbe davens at 10, or the Rebbe davened at 10. Okay, great, but I daven at 7. Like, why should be usher to make Zman Kriyashma? Right, you could think it's, you know, you don't have to, but I'm going to apologize to somebody for davening Bisman?
Yeah.
Nope. Not going to do it. So there's really no connection between Chabad now and the early forms of Chassidus. But this is not to say that Chabad now isn't wildly successful and isn't something that, you know, deserves our support. They really are. They've connected more people to HaKadosh Baruch Hu than any other movement that I'm aware of. And they should be applauded for that. And, you know, the idea that God loves you whether you drive a car on Shabbos or not, I suppose that's true. You know, maybe you should try to get people not to drive on Shabbos. But it all works. And it's all a fantastic thing. And all, you know, again, there's six generations of Lubavitch Rebbes, and it's regular Chassidus. And then there's the seventh. There's Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, and it's a completely different world, and it's a completely different outlook, and it's a completely different vision. But it's successful. And it was successful. And how it keeps being successful, I don't know. I don't think that every Chabad Shlichus is a great thing. You know, I'll tell you honestly, I have a brother-in-law who's a rabbi in Birmingham, Alabama. One shul was enough. You know, Chabad didn't need to show up to siphon off people from his shul to another shul. On the other hand, when you're traveling, you know you're going to find a Chabad house. You know you're going to find a minyan. You know you're going to find a meal, right? That's no small thing, especially when you consider that where's the money coming from, right? All these places need to raise their own money, and they do it, and they're wildly successful. I have a theory which runs out at some point, but I'll tell you this, and then we'll stop. When I was in law school, I used to go to Madison, Wisconsin. We had friends who had a ski boat for the end of the summer. It was great. Okay? We went there to we had to daven in a Chabad house on Shabbos. This is well before any Mashiach thing started. It was no problem to daven there. There was like a 28-year-old guy who opened a Chabad house in Madison, Wisconsin. So I spoke to him. So I said to him, like, do you think you'll be successful? Now, there's no reason to be successful in Madison, Wisconsin, because there aren't that many Jews. He's going to be successful. You know how he knows? It's unbelievable. Because the Rebbe told him. Can you imagine if God came to me and told me to be a plumber, I'd be the world's greatest plumber. Because I would know that I'm doing what HaKadosh Baruch Hu made me to do. When the Rebbe tells you to go to Chile, you know, and open a Chabad house, and you don't speak Chilean, I don't even know there's such a language. Okay, there's no chance. The facts are, there's no chance you'll be successful. On the other hand, the Rebbe told you, b'chvodu v'atzmo, that you'll be successful. All you need is self-confidence. And these people, you know, at least in the old days, had it. I don't know how it works now. Like, I don't know who sends you on shlichus and where you get your self-confidence from. But in those days, you know, God appeared to you and told you to be a shliach in Madison, Wisconsin. There's zero chance that you'll fail when you heard it directly from the Rebbe. It's a strange world. It's an incredible world. It's a world that we should talk about more. But for now, let's have lunch.